is dare to believe. And I think we can interpret that in lots of ways. But, you know, I remember when I got my first computer, it was around 1995. I was so unhappy with it, I threatened to put it on the curb for the trash people. And my husband said, please don't. Just wait till I get home. You don't even look at it again. But it was so overwhelming for me, you know. But then you know how that is. We eventually figure it out and we get comfortable with it. And I remember making business cards. Now, I didn't have any cute publishing program. I just literally used Word. I was a good typist, you know. That's about all I had in terms of those kinds of skills. And I made myself business cards, and I even put a little clip art in it. It was a little bottle of ink. Because I had this idea that ink stood for INK, was imagining noble kismet. And I had this, it was a very plain card, it had a little bottle of ink, and then I had my name, Karen Rice, comma, believer. And certainly I've always been a believer of many things. But I kept thinking about that as I was writing this message, Dare to Believe. And I am, as I mentioned earlier, in this book, The Art of Life, by our founder, the chap that developed this gorgeous philosophy. In the book, The Art of Life, I found this quote, and this is kind of a long quote, so I'm going to break it down and we're going to play with it a little bit as I share it with you. Holmes says, we are a center in the consciousness of God. How about an amen from back there? Amen. Yes, yes, we are a center in the consciousness of God. Sometimes we say we are points of light, but we are all centered. That's why you have to be the center of your own life. We are a center in the consciousness of the God, the mind of God. Since God is everywhere, Holmes says. Oh, we're going to have a fun day. It naturally follows that we always stand at the threshold of divine wisdom, of infinite peace, and perfect power. Since God is always present everywhere, then we are always standing at that divine threshold. We are always right there where perfect peace is. I think that's why in biblically it says there it is a peace that passes our understanding. You'll notice whenever I quote that, I often say that it passes our human understanding because it's so vast and we get so immersed. Like, I liked the reading, it tied in nice, and the music tied in beautifully too as well. But that I like that idea that we stand right there because there can be no place where God is not. So God has to be right here. So we are always standing in that peace, in that power, in that wisdom, in that joy, whatever it is that we have, those divine qualities of God, those desires of our heart. By the way, my new stove works really, really good. I'm so happy. Desire of the heart. You just put that desire out there somewhere and then it gets met. Holmes goes on to say, we may enter in and possess the kingdom as we choose. I paraphrased a little. He said, as we will it to be so. Okay, so we may enter in and possess the kingdom as we choose, but we must have the faith that the kingdom exists. Okay. All right, so we got to have the faith that the kingdom exists. And here is where we must make our claim on God. What a bold thing to say. We must make our claim on God. We must dare to believe that there is a secret place of the Most High, and we are in it now. So he's saying that we have to have the faith, we have to make our claim on it, and that we have to dare to believe it's true. That says to me that just believing is not enough, right? In fact, belief wavers all the time. Our beliefs are always changing. But when we start bumping into those eternal truths, which, by the way, is what this life is all about, we bump into it, we have this opportunity to recognize spiritual truths, universal principles in a deeper and more personal way, then we can stand in our conviction and we can dare to believe some mighty things. So this is an extraordinary statement. I think that it really sums up our entire philosophy, this is one of those talks, a good day to be here for the first time, sums up everything we believe. And what that means is that there is this oneness with God, this way that we are always, we can't not be in it and show up as it. We are given these divine, inherently divine gifts because we are created by this great creator and we're created in the image and likeness of. And so that idea of goodness and peace and power has to be always right at the core of our own being. And when we know it, when we put that claim on God, when we recognize it in the universe, in our lives on a daily basis, that is when we as individuals are revealing the kingdom of heaven right here on earth. Does that sound familiar? There's an echo in here. I just did a really fun talk on echoes recently. So when we recognize that, we are a part of the way that kingdom is revealed here on earth, in heaven as it is on earth, or vice versa, however that says. So I love that we teach this practical form of spirituality. Practical because we can use it. Practical because we are urged, actually sort of demanded to believe it, to dare to jump in and look for those eternal truths. Because when we use it as a, this is where we call it a mental science, that's because we are using our minds in a line of mental reasoning. That's what we teach here, how to use spiritual truths through a line of mental reasoning to understand spiritual laws. And then when we figure out how spiritual laws work, we don't need to reach outside of us to look for any type of healing because we begin to recognize that that wisdom is innately within us already and that we are healed because there's an intelligence in our body that gives us that means. It's already there. But we won't know it if we don't align ourselves to it. So sometimes we use different tools to try and convince ourselves, but don't miss the point. If you have had a healing, if you are now walking around and you weren't a few weeks ago, let's face it, we are grateful to the medical profession or the alternative treatments, whatever it is, but our healing happens quickly when we align our minds and we, through mental reasoning, begin to believe and understand that that's just the way we work, right? All right, got that. So in this chapter 9, Holmes does a really good breakdown of the difference between the conscious mind and the subconscious mind. And I think this is sometimes a challenging topic to address. So I just want you to know there's a very understandable explanation in this reading. But Holmes says that consciousness is twofold, that we have a conscious consciousness and then we have also a subconscious consciousness. Now, the conscious consciousness is that which is, you know, when we're awake, when we're aware, and we're participating, and we're choosing in our lives, we are conscious. And so we are always making choices. And so the conscious consciousness, Holmes says, is that which sort of moves us through life. It's what puts us in that flow as we align ourselves to it and work with it, the everyday movements and activities of life. The subconscious mind, however, this is interesting. I'd never seen it worded quite like this, but Holmes says the subconscious mind is everything that's contained in the conscious mind, but added to that is all your inherited influences. Well, think about that. What are our inherited influences? Well, I mean, it's the way we were raised. It's the beliefs we were exposed to when we were growing up. It's the where we were educated. It's what we've taken interest in. It's the experiences we've had in life and thereby base our beliefs upon, well, if that happened, then that could happen again, so I'm going to walk over here. And it takes all of that. But then he goes on to say it's not just the conscious, all the conscious thought and all your inherited influences, but it is all the beliefs of the entire human race lie in our subconscious mind. Now, this is why I am such a stickler for spiritual practice. This is why I urge us weekly to participate, to use the tools of prayer and of meditation and sitting quietly so we can begin to sense that secret place of the Most High within, that indwelling presence of God itself. Because some of the stuff that we think we believe, if you stop and look at it, you don't even really believe it, right? And so some days I'll say things, odd things will pop out of my mouth and I'll think, because I'm trained in this, I have skills in this, I practice a lot, right? That was supposed to be funny. I'm just like you. I am just like everybody else. You are just like me. When we have any kind of spiritual practice, we rise above the law of averages. We no longer have to be a victim to what everybody else is thinking because we hone in that divine way to that pattern for our life to where we see we are in choice and we can stand and we can dare to believe even when our thoughts and beliefs are quite different than other people's. So now look at the school of psychology. The classic psychologists are always diving deep into the subconscious, right? You know, there's that way that they look at the childhood. You know, things that this is what they say, that the things that happen to us in our childhood that you hang on to with your child's mind, right? It's not your adult mind, and yet a lot of us are pretty set in our ways based on things that happened in our childhood. And the psychologist's work is to dig that up so that you can see it, recognize it, acknowledge it, and grow up and see it through adult eyes so that you know you're not a child anymore, so that you know those thoughts and feelings can't hurt you anymore. And the problem with those buried thoughts is that those are the places from which we get our guilt and our unworthiness. You know, the child is afraid of not being loved or not being wanted or of being rejected. And most of us carry some of that around with us. So all of life, I really think probably the purpose of life, one of the purposes of life, is for us to look at that so that we can come back to that place that Holmes was talking about in that first passage I read, where we recognize, but we're not broken. That's because God has to be right here, right now. So does my wholeness. So does my perfection. So does my ability to love and be loved. And then our lives, as we begin to wrap our mind around that type of thinking, our lives are changed. You know, even in our school of ministry, if you are going through our school of ministry at CSL, and you are earning a master's degree, you are required to take a whole component of study on spiritual psychology. Sometimes we call that depth psychology. And those are really fun classes for me, because I was always interested in all of that. But I want you to see that this is a part of our teaching. But here's where we're different than traditional psychology. In the teaching of the science of mind, we approach the same issues that the psychologist might approach, but we do it from a slightly different perspective. Holmes wrote, and actually Sue Witter, you read this from a different book in a slightly different wording. The subconscious mind contains only what has been put into it. So sometimes we put it there. Sometimes other people seed it for us. Sometimes we've got that inherited, we're just sort of influenced by the way, you know, they say I don't know if this is still true, but you know, if your parents voted politically this way, you probably will too, you know, and used to be that if you grew up with that religion, that was probably gonna be your religion. Looks to me like we're thinking a little more independently than that now, and that's a good thing. But what are some of the subtle beliefs that we still hold? This is what all of our education is about when you take classes here. It's about re-educating our subconscious mind. It's about knowing that seeds have been planted, some of them by choice and many not by choice, but that we can pull out the weeds of the sproutings that we don't want, and we can always plant new seeds. Therefore, we are always open to better and greater experiences in our life and broader possibilities. So when we think according to those inward divine patterns, when we stand in that place of the secret place of the Most High, you know, when we're like aware of that, then we think differently. Then when these problem thoughts try and peek in our mind, we easily neutralize them. We change direction. We catch them. We notice what we're thinking, and we make a different decision. So we transmute. Sometimes we even erase the old beliefs just by putting a truth in its place. Some, absolutely, absolutely. So this is what Holmes means when he says tapping into the secret place of the Most High. This is what he's talking about. It's only secret because it's not so visible. We have to intend to dive into it. This is also what we mean when we talk about the Christ consciousness. This is the same idea. This is the message that Jesus spoke about when Jesus came and had a ministry and a message. This is also what we might call spiritual illumination. But let me say this. Doesn't matter what we call it. What matters is that we acknowledge it, we open ourselves to it, and we use it. Because when we use it, it changes our life. See, we begin to have higher thoughts. And when you have, think of it as wisdom. You know, you get experiences, but then you add to that an understanding. We follow that line, that logical line of reasoning. We see that we have this here in this practical spirituality. And so, you know how you hear us say, when you know better, you do better, right? So with more information, we know better, and we're coming from a higher perspective, and so we make decisions from there, and we have a higher or a better outcome in our life, and it just makes sense. It's so easy. So it is, kind of. Just keep coming every Sunday. But it comes back to that bold statement at the very top of the message this morning where Holmes said we have to have faith in the secret place of the Most High. We have to put our claim on God. We have to recognize our divinity, I would say, would be the best way to look at that. And then we have to dare to believe. Holmes says, this is the place, this is why healing happens, this is the place where the universal meets us in its wholeness without any restriction whatsoever. So when we approach anything that's going on in our life, whether it's a financial situation, a relationship that appears strained, moving, and it appears your life is in total chaos, there is a way that we can still stand in our truth and see the beauty of the divine order revealing itself amidst what could be ugly or disorderly. It could seem very disorderly. I have done my work this week, let me tell you. So sometimes we have to dare to believe we are standing in that divine order and harmony no matter what's going on in front of us, and it's a really beautiful practice to do that. This Friday, I completed my Seeds of Peace class, and oh my goodness, we had an amazing experience meeting for those 4 weeks and looking at four different great, fascinating people. And what I noticed is, it's easy to say that each of the individuals we looked at, and all the many, 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 too numerous to mention, but that they all had that in common, that they dared to believe in something, that they dared to take a stand for something. And the gentleman that we looked at this week was someone brand new to me. I had never heard of this person before. His name is Nader Khalili. And Nader Khalili he passed in 2008, but he did remarkable things with his life. He was an Iranian American. He actually had residence in both California and Tehran. And he was a well-known architect. And he was known for building these and designing these elaborate skyscrapers. And in the 1970s and in the 1980s, he just did this prolific work around the world. And he was well-respected, and he had a tidy little career all wrapped up for himself. And then something happened. Some of you know how life blindsides you at the theater or wherever you might be, right? And he had a heart attack. He wasn't very old, and he had a heart attack. And you know how when your mortality gets in your face, that's the time to reevaluate what you believe. That's the time. Don't miss that opportunity. You don't want life to bring you a second time of that. So he had a heart attack, but while he was recovering from his heart attack, his best friend was killed in an accident. And so he just gave up his career, and he started questioning life and his purpose in life, and what do I want to do with the rest of my life? And so he did an interesting thing. My husband will appreciate this. Did you ride the motorcycle today? Oh, brave soul, isn't he? So he took a 5-year motorcycle trek through Iran, through the back roads and all the raw country, and might not be much different than what that would look like here, huh, if we did that, but for 5 years. Now, I also should mention that he was a bit of a mystic. He was very spiritual, and he had an affinity for Rumi. And he not only loved Rumi, but because he knew the language, he translated about 375 Rumi poems and published 2 books of Rumi's poetry with his own translations. So he was a philosopher / architect, interesting being, and he understood life both in the linear and sort of the mysterious way. Now he's going through this traumatic experience. For 5 years, he rides his motorcycle all over Iran, and he begins to notice that it's sort of depressing, that there are lots of villages that are void of people because they have had, in some cases, a terrible earthquake just demolished all the buildings and it was uninhabitable. A flood hit another area. War tore lots of the villages in that region. And what he noticed was, over time, because he was just doing his philosopher thing, what he noticed was that in the villages around the kiln, that everything would be in perfect order. And so he saw that the heat, the baking, the firing process did something to preserve the structures near the kiln. So he began to use his architect mind. He called on that wisdom, and he had this idea of making affordable, durable, and environmentally friendly buildings that could sustain life, that could be built quickly for people who are homeless, refugees, or people after a devastating natural disaster or in the war-torn areas. And so he made this weave of mud, and it's just all earth. He calls it earth bricks, and he baked them and fired them, and he began to build houses, and he built a school, and then he started traveling around the world and teaching people how to do this, and he got people in California interested, and they built out in the Mojave Desert right by the fault line. They built a big structure to see how it would withstand some of the earthquakes, and to this day, they are, I believe, I don't know how current the information was, they were very durable, very durable, lasting. They could move as they needed to remain in that structure. So he did this, and he even named it something, but you know what happened was NASA got word. NASA started hearing about these special bricks this guy was making, and he was making them just out of the earth, and they last and they're easy to use. And so NASA, in 1984, NASA contacted Nader Khalili and said, please come speak at our next big conference. We're bringing all the scientists together to talk about what it would take to build on the moon. And he went, and he was the most popular speaker. Here's all these scientists. I'm so tempted to call them nerdy, but some of us here are nerds. I don't want to say that improperly. But, they stood and they cheered him on at the end of his presentation because his work was so impressive. Later, Nader Khalili went on and he became intrigued with the, you know what happens after war? This was his observation. After war, people remain and the soldiers clear away, and there was always sandbags and barbed wire left over. All these reminders of war. And he thought, I think we can use those. What if we could make, so he has this whole new idea based on the idea he's already worked on. And he takes his architect mind and using the idea of domes and arches and vaults, he takes the sandbags and he wraps barbed wire around him and he forms all these angles and they put the mud around it. And for no cost, and very quickly, they make these amazing homes, and anybody can learn to do it. He said that if a person could lift a 5-pound coffee can of dirt, you could learn to do this process. And then he went on and made videos and did demonstrations and traveled around the world helping people adapt the dirt that was theirs, because let's face it, soil's different all around, right? And into styles that fit their culture. What an amazing thing this person did. And I know some of you are thinking, because this is what happened when we talked about him on Friday night. People said, why don't we know of him? I don't know. That's a really good question. Why do we spend more time on the negative news and miss beautiful stories such as this? And I want to tell you, I have a whole book full of them. There's quite a number of impressive stories and people. He had a passion for helping people who were homeless and had immediate need of housing. The refugees, the people who were prone to natural disasters. And what they found with his, by the way, they called that barbed wire sandbag home a super adobe. And what they have found is that the super adobe homes are considered resistant to natural disasters. That's impressive stuff. This is a guy who dared to dream. You see, what happens in a situation like that is someone feels that divine impulse within. There is a way that Holmes says, we have to build our new thoughts on some new impulsion. Isn't that a great word, impulsion? So these thoughts are, it's something in us, it's impelled for them to be evident. So there's a divine impulse. And what I want to tell you is that every great peacemaker that we studied demonstrated some sort of divine impulse. It's rather remarkable, but they not only dared to believe, but before they dared to believe, now hear this, this is the important part of the message. Before they dared to believe, before they stood peacefully in peace, they felt the discomfort of some sort of injustice that they either experienced or witnessed. Gandhi. Gandhi boarded a train with a first-class ticket and was removed from the first-class compartment. People of color are not permitted to do that. And he sat in the train station all night long. He never went home. He sat there and he pondered, why does this happen? How could this be? I don't understand this. This was a great injustice. And he stayed with it all night long, and he came up with this idea that eventually became his view of nonviolent activism. Many have modeled the example that Gandhi left. Thich Nhat Hanh, as a young boy, wanted to be a Buddhist monk. When he was in his young adult years, he founded and built his own monastery in Vietnam. And you know what happened? It wasn't long before war surrounded the monastery. And here are all the monks praying and meditating in their peaceful little monastery, and they're hearing the cries of all the people outside. And Thich Nhat Hanh was brilliant in his understanding of this. He said, we can't just sit here and pray. We can't just meditate like nothing's going on. Buddhism is based on compassion. We have to do something. And in that urge, answering that divine impulse, he created this idea of engaged activism, engaged Buddhism. Yes? Jane Goodall, we studied Jane Goodall a couple weeks ago. Oh my goodness. Just a little girl that loved nature, reading her little Tarzan books while she's growing up, gets this great desire to go to Africa. She studies to be a secretary, because that's what all good women did, either that or teachers, right? And she becomes a secretary because her parents tell her, you know, this will sustain you your whole life. And she saves every penny she makes from her first job till she can afford a one-way ticket. She gets on a ship and goes to Africa, where she meets Dr. Louis Leakey, who hires her as his secretary. And they work together, they grow, they bond together, and he notices she's got some crazy kind of observation skills, and he puts her in the field with the chimpanzees. No scientific training whatsoever, and she becomes this person who took a stand for what she dared to believe and began the work of stopping laboratory testing of animals. Beautiful stories. Each one of these great peacemakers, each in his or her own way, was very deeply spiritual. If you study their stories, not necessarily religious, but I want you to hear that they took their time. They didn't just wake up as heroes. They walked through their life. Nader spent 5 years on his motorcycle trying to figure out what he was going to do and what mattered, because what he knew was that we may not know the meaning of life, but the only thing that matters is that we make our lives meaningful. And with that idea, he began to take a stand for something a lot more humble than that great work he was doing with the urban skyscrapers. Each of these great thinkers, we can see in their examples, they went through that process of mental reasoning. They dared to believe that they could make a difference. And every time that we change our mind about an old belief, we are planting new seeds of possibility in our own lives. Yeah, absolutely. See, the peacemakers did not probably, I mean, think of their stories. It's not likely that they felt very peaceful while they were daring to stand for what they believed. And so sometimes, even if it's standing up for for taking care of ourselves, sometimes it's saying no to something you're asked to do. It's being assertive and taking a stand for yourself so you can have more peace in your life. Sometimes it will ruffle the feathers of others, and yet we can stand in our truth and thereby allow that ripple to be a bigger example of how we bring peace into the world. Peace starts in ordinary ways. Great peacemakers were once ordinary people who just took it day by day and stood up for what they believed was right. I want to end this morning with a gorgeous quote from The Course in Miracles that I haven't thought about in a long time till I was writing this message. There's a line in The Course in Miracles that says, "All are called, few choose to listen." My friends, we all have that divine impulse within us. You can't hide it. You can't sit on it very long. It will be the very thing that makes us uneasy if we don't figure out what it is we're called to do. And no act is too small to be a part of that greater gift that we bring to the planet when we take a stand for what we believe, when we choose to be peaceful when we could choose otherwise, when we make a commitment to membership in a spiritual community that supports such thinking, in the way that we interact in the social hall or in the board meeting that's going to follow this message. Life invites us again and again to that glorious, beautiful opportunity of recognizing our own divinity, the secret place of the Most High. Yes, we can have faith in it. Yes, we can put our claim on God. And yes, we can stand strong and dare to believe. I would like to anchor these words in prayer right now. So I invite you just to get comfortable where you're seated.